they say we should have known better than to fall so deep down into this rabbit hole.
Get
we found
ready. It's time again to venture down the rabbit hole into the world of cybersecurity. You're plugged into the podcast for security leaders and practitioners with a business sense. Prepare for unique interviews, insights, and practical advice that makes your job just a bit easier. And now, please welcome your guides on this adventure, James Jardine and the White Rabbit, Ruffalos.
Hey folks, welcome down the Security Rabbit Hole to another Down the Security Rabbit Hole podcast. This is Raf. I'm running solo today. James is off doing that school thing, end of season, and you're listening to episode 301, starting the next round of awesome 100 episodes. And I've got a great guest for you guys today. We've been talking about the concept of what security really means. In sort of the broader picture, the broader scheme of what our jobs relate to in kind of the real world and finance and identity. And I thought after seeing some research, I thought who better to have on that than somebody that actually does research and has a tremendous wealth of expertise in that. So on that note, welcome Julie Conroy to the show from the ITA Group. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you today, Raf?
Good. So can you, just for the audience sake, folks that don't have looked you up yet, give us a little background and history of who you are and where you come from.
Sure. So ITA Group is a Boston-based research and consulting firm. And we spend a lot of time talking to executives in financial institutions and e-commerce firms about the challenges driving their business, the opportunities, and I focus on fraud, which is a really fun space to spend all of my time in. So as we, as I talk to the industry, and I've spent my entire career looking at how the fraudsters are impacting payments and banking. Right now it's a bit of a lopsided battle because the bad guys are, they're not just some kid in his basement. It's organized crime rings that we're up against here, and they are smart, they're well funded, and they're kind of winning the war right now.
So that's an interesting place to start. When you say winning the war, tell me what that means to you from the perspective that you provide.
So it means that they are able to evolve their attacks faster than the good guys, than we are able to keep up. And so we're seeing that the fraud losses incurred by financial institutions and e-commerce merchants just continue to rise, even while at the same time we keep deploying more and more technologies to try to stop them. It's kind of like a lopsided game of chess where for every three moves that they get, we only get one move.
That's interesting. So where does that lead us? Because I know there have been lots of conversations had on the scope and scale of, for example, e-fraud when it comes to, kind of specific to credit card fraud, right? The total global number in how many, the volume of fraud or real transactions versus how much fraud there is. And I had somebody on the show, gosh, it's been a long time, but we basically came to the conclusion that the amount of fraud in the system right now is just right, any more and we'll start to see negative impact, any less and our countermeasures are too expensive. Is it still that way today?
I would say that yes, we still are at that kind of fine balance, because as I talk to banks and e-commerce merchants, they are just as concerned about making sure that the countermeasures don't create really bad customer service experiences and too much friction. But at the same time, we're seeing that in the card-not-present environment in a lot of countries around the globe, fraud is rising faster than the pace of e-commerce itself. Which
that's interesting.
Says a lot, because e-commerce is rising pretty fast in a lot of countries.
That's interesting. And you mentioned the card-not-present side of it. Is the chip and pin conversation and innovation, or chip and sign in the U.S. here, is that kind of what's driving that?
That's a small part of it. It is the fact that fraud is kind of like squeezing a balloon. You take the fraud out of one part of the ecosystem, And it doesn't go away. These organized crime rings aren't going to go and get real jobs. They switch their tactics. And so we are seeing that shift of fraud, but it's also what, you know, we're seeing net new increment of fraud. Because as you look at the fact that we've got close to 10 billion data records that have been breached since 2013, personally identifiable information, credentials, it means that basically the bad guys have all of our data. And so they're using it. And so it's not just that, you know, fraud migration, it's also they're finding new opportunity for fraud out there.
Well, that's the thing that we were all concerned about when a particularly credit agency got breached was that, you know, the things that we, the mechanisms and the levers that we had at our disposal to verify somebody really and truly were things like things about your credit history, things about your past from a financial aspect. And when that was stolen, we're like, well, great, now what?
Well, and quite honestly, you know, they had most of that data already anyway because of the Anthem breach. Yeah, exactly. What that data did was it really gave them a refresh on that data. So, yeah, as I had been talking to financial institutions for a new account fraud, for example, one of the great tells that you know, the bad guys had bought your personally identifiable information out of the Anthem breach and were using it a year later was that they would come in and they would have all of your data. They would have a good address for you, but that address was 2 years old. The big breach last year did was it refreshed a lot of that data. So it gave them a refreshed address. It gave them a refreshed phone number. So they could look even better coming in the door, which really reinforces the trend that I've been seeing for a long time, which is that it's not just about the static data that the bad guys have. You got to look at all of the digital identity data that we leave behind as we transact. You know, the fact that I have a Samsung smartphone and a Dell PC, and those are my primary devices that I use when I'm transacting online. And, you know, these are the fingerprints and footprints associated with this device. This is how long I've had my email. This is the reputation associated with it. All of that is incredibly valuable when it comes to determining, is this me or is this somebody that bought my identity on the dark web?
Right. So I've seen that. I think they called it identity analytics, is how I've heard it referred to. Basically, things that are beyond passwords, like we're, you know, geo-positioning and like what you discussed just now, the cell phone that you're using, the browser that you use, the cookies you have, that kind of thing, that are trying to fingerprint people much more deeply to help prevent some of that card-not-present fraud.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's card-not-present fraud. It's preventing new account fraud. It's helping to detect synthetic identity fraud because that's another key attack vector that's on the rise where it's not just pure identity theft, but the criminals will just concoct new identities and set up new credit histories for these identities. And one of the really insidious parts of that is one of their favorite things to do is steal the social security number of a child. Because they're not going to transact until they're 18, so they probably won't even realize it until they go to get that first line of credit.
Oh, that's all. So that's dastardly, right? I mean, I've got you know, credit monitoring for my 4.5-year-olds, which sounds insane until you realize that. I mean, who would give a credit card to a 4-year-old? Seriously, though.
Well, but what they do, and yeah, is that they don't present themselves as a 4-year-old. They use that social security number. But then they'll come in with the date of birth of a 30-year-old and, you know, a made-up address or a mail drop address, made-up name. And because that real child hasn't been reported to a credit agency yet, that new identity around that social security number gets set up as the identity associated with that social. And so because, you know, by law, the credit bureaus are not allowed to use social security number as a primary key for their credit reporting services.
Right.
And right now, it's very difficult and cumbersome to inquire with the Social Security Administration, you know, does John Doe own this social security number? Now, a bit of good news with all this doom and gloom is there was a bill that just passed this Congress that would make it easier to verify with the Social Security Administration. So that could help with this particular attack vector, although there's still a lot of details to work out to figure out, you know, just what the mechanism is going to be. So, you know, a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel, but it's pretty far down that tunnel right now.
Well, so, I mean, look, we've been talking about the fact that social security number as an identifier is a terrible thing because it was never meant to be a secret. I mean, when I was in college, we put it on all our IDs. My license had it. My checks had my SSN on them. My doctor's office still asks for them. Every time I go somewhere, they want my social. And nobody knows how to protect this or why it's even, you know, supposed to be a secret. Why are we using SSNs that way, and why haven't we gotten off of them?
Well, yeah, the reality is that as much as the Social Security Administration has protested that, you know, the Social Security number was not intended to be a national identifier, you know, it is a de facto national identifier right now because we don't have a national federal ID system. There are countries that do, and you know, there's similar, I think, gaps in that, although we are seeing some more robust systems come where, you know, you do have a biometric or, you know, a cryptographic chip that's embedded in that card, which makes it harder to breach that data. But, you know, the criminals always find a way. You look at, you know, India, which is one of the leaders with associating biometrics with all of their systems, or all of their citizens. It's called the Aadhaar system. But, you know, there's also a number associated with that Aadhaar identity. And there was a data leakage where 1 million of the Aadhaar numbers were posted to a publicly available website. So, yeah, the Social Security number is not the ideal, and that's really why we can't rely solely on that. We need to supplement it with all of these various forms of digital identity.
Okay, so do you see something? I mean, every time somebody mentions national identity, I know a bunch of my peers in security, we kind of freak just a little bit, you know, for privacy, and you don't want the government, you know, tracking us like that, and have, you know, a microchipped card that you have to use everywhere, and I get that, but that certainly, I mean, it certainly provides a bit of stability and defense into that identity system.
And there's a whole bunch of countries that have gone there. Yeah, there's some great examples around the globe, from, you know, Chile to the Maldives. You know, not necessarily the places you would necessarily associate being the on the leading edge of this type of technology. But we've also seen some of the cases gone wrong. You know, with Estonia, they had a national identity provision to a mobile device. And then they pulled back on that last year because it turned out that there was some security gaps in their mobile security on that particular device. Yeah, in the U.S., given our current political environment, given the fact that you know, things like driver's license are, you know, federated among the states, I don't see us going down that path anytime soon, because it would take congressional action to make that happen.
So in the meantime, because we know congressional action will be swift and thought through well, and done very, very expediently, tongue in cheek. But so what do we, I mean, how do we do this until then? Because if the system is getting, and particularly on the fraud side, if it's getting out of balance, then, you know, and this being a security-focused podcast, but this is definitely a topic that I think we need to tackle, what can we do from the security perspective that can contribute to the safety, to the verifiability of these platforms? And please don't say stop breaches, because we've tried.
yeah, the breaches, yeah, that's that one's out of the cat's out of the bag on that one. You know, it's really, again, it goes back to making the investments in these types of digital identity technology, you know, things like device fingerprinting, behavioral biometrics that looks at the way somebody interacts with their device, you know, looking at reputational databases and sharing information in that way. And then also applying machine learning analytics to all of this data so that we can take it from this, you know, mass of data into something that is actionable. And that's where I see both e-commerce firms and banks investing a lot of time and money, because this does really help them strike that balance between fraud prevention and maintaining a good customer experience.
So that always is that's always the balance, right? We balance everything on that fulcrum of customer experience, and we sort of fall. And that's I think that's one of the reasons why passwords have been such a the answer and the problem in the same sentence, because to minimize the impact to the customer, right? It'd be great if we all had one-time authenticators, a la the RSA tokens, right? It would be great if every site we logged into, every resource we used had that. But then you'd be carrying around a garbage bag full of those, and it's not a good customer experience. Nobody's built a central broker for that really yet. I mean, the Google Microsoft Authenticator, Google Authenticator, those have come close, but then you've got worry about adoption issues. How do we get better at that?
Well, you know, one of the big challenges is that in most countries, consumers don't really have a vested interest in putting up with friction or participating in security, because you know we have zero liability. We have zero liability for credit card fraud. Here in the U.S., Reg E protects us from online banking fraud. And so, yeah, as we survey consumers, they're willing to participate to a certain point as long as it is super easy. Now, the good news is that the mobile devices that are now ever-present in our lives create opportunities to introduce security that is very easy. So, yeah, you can leverage the fact that you know, we have robust cameras that can help with facial recognition. We have fingerprints on these devices. If you have an app on your device, we don't need those RSA tokens. You can just push a one-time password through the app. And so I do see that we're finding ways through that mobile device to enable security. The folks that are doing it best out there are enabling consumers to choose which form of authentication they prefer, because what works for me and what I prefer is going to be different than what works for you, and certainly different than what works for my mom.
So I get it. The challenge becomes then with, you know, the large companies, Amazon, Walmart, right? The big retailers, they can give us choice because they have the capacity financially and technologically to be able to do that for us. But the smaller shops that are trying to compete, that are trying to stay competitive, can they afford to give us that kind of choice? I mean, I know technology is getting cheaper, but it's not that ubiquitous yet. So how do small companies or even competitors stay competitive without having to up the war on what they're spending?
Well, the good news with, you know, for small e-commerce merchants, for smaller banks, they often rely on technology platforms that can enable this for them. And if those platforms are doing this at scale, it makes it much more accessible to those smaller firms.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. Are you finding is that kind of what's happening out there? Are we getting like identity providers or federated identity kind of brokers? I know you're able to log into several places now. Log in using your Amazon ID, which is I'm always a little suspect of, quite frankly. But is that kind of where we're going? A world of sort of centralized identity management at some broader scale that then federates out. Like, is Google eventually going to win this? And because they probably have the most info on all of our identities, right? Are they eventually going to become the identity provider, or Facebook? So you'll go to, you know, your bank, you'll log in with Facebook.
As I talk to banks, not one of them is interested in trusting Facebook at this point.
Good. Neither do I.
But I think we are seeing banks looking at getting into the business of federated identities. So, you know, Capital One just acquired a identity management firm called Confirm. And I think that is a clear indication that there is interest on the part of banks, you know, who are a trusted entity in most consumers' lives to serve this role. We are super early, especially in the U.S., moving towards federated identity, but I think there is potential there.
So you're right. I kind of have to trust my bank. That's where my money is, like that or not. That's interesting about that, about them acquiring identity a company, because that certainly does at least signal the start of a move. Do you think that's going to become a broader trend? You think Citi and Chase and B of A and Wells are all going to follow?
I think at least some of them probably will. It's probably not all of them, and it's really all about how do they envision their relationship with consumers 10 years from now? Because that's really the time horizon we're talking about for true federated identity to take hold here.
Wow, that long, huh?
Yeah. There's a lot of hurdles to overcome. And as you look at that login that you were talking about, the login is really just a database lookup at this point, because all of your credentials are compromised. so there are so many layers of analysis and authentication that are taking place behind that login that I don't talk to many sophisticated players that are willing to relinquish any of that control to a federated identity yet.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. I mean, but then we're stuck with this sort of fractured model, and we know from a security perspective, anytime something is heavily fractured, complexity is introduced into the system, and complexity makes security difficult. So protecting this stuff is going to continue to be challenging for at least 10 years. I mean, is the expectation then from my side of this table is don't expect breaches to slow down.
They won't. But what I'm seeing emerge is that those players that are investing in this technology, the digital identity technology, the machine learning, are creating a competitive advantage for themselves. So there becomes a competitive advantage to doing this really well.
Right. Well, that makes sense. I mean, I guess that's one way of getting really competitive in terms of cutting the kind of cost. If you can cut fraud, you can cut the costs that are hurting your business, and then focus on that becomes a competitive advantage. I know security has talked about being the competitive advantage in lots of companies, but this is starting to feel like that may actually be a reality.
Yeah, absolutely. We are seeing it out there, because not only are you better at protecting the bottom line, but you're able to enable better customer experiences and able to deploy more and more robust transaction types.
Right. Well, that makes sense. I mean, look, in any regular environment, you've probably got dozens of passwords. I mean, that's why we all have password vaults and password tools, because, I mean, I looked at the last I checked, I've got just under 500 different identities. And that's not counting all the places existing identities are federated to, the Facebook, the Google login, the such. We use LinkedIn to log into certain tools. But, I mean, under 500, that's insane, right? That's not even possible to do that on in a manual way. And that's counting some of the places where I go repeatedly. Now, I'll tell you, if I go to a website that says, hey, register to get this report, I'll make up a password that I'm never going to remember, and I don't even care that I'm not going to remember, because it's a throwaway, right? So the reality is I've got probably way over 500 places I have identities. Those are just the ones I care about. Should I expect that to start collapsing in the next decade, slowly?
Very, very slowly. I think that is going to be the status quo for some time to come. And that's why we're seeing that banks, e-commerce firms are building their security with the assumption that the consumer is using the same set of username passwords across most of their online relationships, because we have the research that shows that they do.
Yeah.
And building their security with the assumption that those credentials are compromised. So let's analyze this session, the device, the behavior, and base our decisions on that, not on whether they're entering the right credentials.
Yeah. So okay, that's actually a complete. So that's something that's it's not new, because I used to work for a company that bought this. I want to say 2006, 2007 as a service into the platform that they were using. And they called it something weird. It was like identity telemetry or something like that. And then I think Bank of America ended up buying that platform and turned into the B of A multi sign-on mutual authentication kind of device that they were doing. But so that, okay, that makes, that's starting to make sense now from a from the perspective of the user, because we're probably as the user never going to see a lot of that stuff that's more advanced that's happening on the back end. We'll just keep using our username and password, right?
That's exactly right. And yeah, that's why a lot of consumers still believe username and password is actually an effective security mechanism, which is good news, bad news. You know, it keeps them using online properties and resources, but it also gives them a false sense of security. But it's not entirely a false sense of security because there are so many layered technologies that consumers just aren't even aware of.
Well, because as far as they know, the username and password is perfectly fine. Meanwhile, you know, there's 27 back-end systems that verify their identity, their geolocation, do a database lookup on who they are. Interesting. So where does the intersection of identity and security moving forward? Because in security, we've been talking for the last 3 years or so, how the next forefront, the next battle over, next battle in security, the next frontier is really going to be, at least for the foreseeable future, the identity. Like we've collapsed it down to the individual identity, and IAM has become the topic. From an identity federation, identity management, data governance, like all those components of identity have become the hot topic, and conferences are springing up around that, and there's more vendors than anybody can count. Where is that? Where, from your research, how is that space evolving? Do you have any data on that you can share?
Well, I think the biggest trend that we're seeing there is one that's starting in Europe and is going to spread around the globe with GDPR. So we all saw our email boxes flooded last week with all the GDPR notices and, you know, plenty of phishing attacks mixed in. GDPR isn't stopping in Europe. That consumer control of data, it's already coming in Australia and Canada. And, yeah, eventually, once our Congress figures out how to do something, it'll come here too.
So do you think there's going to be a U.S. version of GDPR?
Eventually. It's not going to happen it's not going to happen tomorrow, but I do think it's inevitable, especially in the wake of what we saw with the credit bureau breach last year, Cambridge Analytica this year. There is increasing concern about where our data is, where our identity is, and who's got access to it. I think if we see House flip in November, we will definitely see some action on this front. We might not see a bill passed, but we'll definitely see some bills come out of committee, because there's already bills floating around on this.
So, but we've been talking about a national data breach policy, right? A national data breach law. And we've had John Tum on the show a couple of times, and we joke around, you know, it's this close, but it's never going to happen because there's so many different special interests, so many different localities, so many different constituents. Do you think we're going to get a national data breach law too, maybe?
I'm a little less optimistic there just because we have this existing patchwork of state laws that are filling the gap right now. So they, you know, in some ways, we're actually ahead of a lot of countries with our data breach regulation because of what the states have done. With something like GDPR and consumer control of data, that's a place where there's more of a vacuum to be filled. And so I think there's more of a chance that we'll see something happen on the national level versus the state level.
Interesting. Okay. Well, that makes sense. Interesting. I'm thinking of sort of the potential for any time like the feds get involved in some of this stuff, the conversations always slow down, and they're already going at glacial paces. Agreeing on details, agreeing on timelines, agreeing on where it's going to be stored, who's going to administer it, who the contract's going to go to. I think, you know, intentions are great, but I think I've seen every bill we've seen that's stalled has gone to hell in that spot, right in that last mile. I'd love to see some sort of ID identity thing happen. I don't know, especially like a national privacy, you know, identity privacy thing. That would be fantastic. I guess, hell, why? I hesitate to say this because somebody will try it, but you know, just simply copy and pasting GDPR and saying, look, if it's good enough for the Europeans, it's good enough for us. But the joke was on Twitter the other day when, as you know, as 25th approached, this is going to break so many business models. So many companies are just going to stop doing business with the EU. And as we joked about it, like the TSA, the LA Times all put up websites that said, sorry, you're part of Europe. We don't want to deal with you.
Yeah, you know, I actually think GDPR is a little bit like Y2K, that there was, you know, a whole bunch of consternation, and it's, you know, in a lot of ways, I think it's going to turn out to be a bit overblown, just from the standpoint that, you know, the first payment services directive had elements of, you know, GDPR already. So this wasn't something that was completely new. And at the end of the day, you know, it's all about preparing yourself for consumers to exercise their right to forget and their right for data portability. But how many of your average European consumers actually even know about this right and know what they should do and want to do it? Because, you know, having somebody remember that you're a customer and your preferences provides a better customer experience. So, you know, there was a lot of preparation, but I do think it's, you know, it's going to be a little bit of an anticlimax over the next few months. But on the plus side, I also do think that you know, Europe's going first, and so we'll be able to learn from what works and what doesn't as, you know, next year Australia follows suit, you know, Canada's right behind them, and, you know, eventually the U.S.
Eventually the Americans will catch up, huh? We are certainly, as a country, and I know this is going in a different direction slightly, but we are certainly well behind the rest of the world in terms of what we consider. You know, we talk a lot about privacy, but people are willing to trade it for a candy bar. They'll trade their password for a candy bar. They'll give away all of their personal information, you know, into the Facebooks of the world. They don't, like, our consumers, our end users don't seem to really, like, honestly and truly care about privacy. Are they going to, can we make them care about identity when you've got zero fraud liability from the banks, you know, and all that back end stuff?
You know, just like with any other topic, you have your groups of consumers that do care, and, you know, it matters to them. A lot of folks don't. And I think that the key to getting, you know, the mass population on board is going to be, you know, does this create new paths of opportunity, new access to convenient services? Because, you know, as we do consumer surveys, convenience trumps privacy and security. So is there a way to spin this to make it more convenient, easier for consumers to access things?
Yeah, well, we are a society of convenience. I think that is real and true. Anybody that's worked in security, anytime you try to put something ahead of convenience, you can almost be certain you're going to lose. There's got to be an antidote for that, because, I mean, look, the reality is it's going to continue to cost us money. If you're telling me the global fraud rates on e-crime, card not present, are starting to go up, that means we're going to fairly quickly, I imagine, get into that place where we're uncomfortable or the system is not right, and we'll have to see a rebalancing, what that rebalancing looks like, whether it's more spending into the identity side, into the analytics, into the fraud reduction funnel. I almost wonder what that's going to look like and what the consumer reaction is going to be to that.
Well, the one thing that's been keeping us at pace is just that we do have technology like digital identity that helps us to recoup, you know, helps us to keep up, and maybe not keep up, maybe just not get too far behind. So, you know, I think that we will continue to see folks strive to create the good customer experiences, because that's where the revenue comes from. And unfortunately, as you look at business, revenue often trumps security.
So now we've got two things: revenue and convenience are ahead of security. Meanwhile, security continues to be the topic of discussion everywhere. I feel like a lot of us are paying lip service to it and talking about it. But then the new credit card comes in the mail, and you're like, oh crap, another one. Oh well. Right, and it just sort of rinse and repeat.
Yeah, you know, again, we it's interesting as we look at our client base across the globe, because you know, as I talk to Swedish banks, for example, you know, their consumers expect some friction and they get actually uncomfortable when it's not there because they don't feel protected.
Is that a cultural thing?
It is the fact that they have implemented much tougher requirements to access online banking. You know, you have to have a token, and now it's great because it's actually being moved to a mobile app push, so you don't have to carry this hard token around with you everywhere.
Right.
But they, the consumers there from the get-go were indoctrinated into this higher security environment, so it's now the expectation, and when that that visible security isn't there, there's a level of discomfort. We're kind of at the opposite end of that spectrum here. And it's I think at this point it'd be very difficult to transition our consumers to that type of expectation.
So something interesting, and I think this may be kind of the last topic we tackle here, but we've gotten to the point where I think NIST put out a guidance that said using your cell phone to, the SMS kind of authentication, that's a two-step that we have now, that's fairly common. Like, that is not safe. That is not secure. Don't do that. I tell you, while that may not be secure, in my opinion, for high security applications, I think for the average person, it's a lot better than their current means. What are your thoughts on that? Because you're talking about identity, sort of the analytics and the other bits behind that. Certainly, that your phone is one of those things.
Well, it was interesting. So NIST proposed guidance deprecated SMS OTP.
That's it. Right. You're right.
When they came out with the final guidance, they actually backed off of that. And that was because of heavy pushback by industry. Because, to your point, SMS OTP is way better than password, just username, password.
Yeah.
And there's actually ways at strengthening that so that you are looking for things like call forwarding and you are verifying with MNO data that, Roth is the owner of this mobile number. So I still do see heavy use of SMS OTP, increasing use of SMS OTP, especially in banking. But you have to have the layers of security around it, because by itself, just like any fraud prevention capability, by itself, it is susceptible.
That's a fair point. So I think the lesson here is that the complexity is going to the complexity around protecting identity is going to continue to get to increase. But the trend is going to be to make it invisible to the customer, and so it's going to happen. It's going to fall to the responsibility of those folks that are listening on the phone, on this call right now, at this podcast, to really kind of do the job of making it transparent, hiding it behind the veil, so that the consumer is, I don't want to use the word ignorant of, but doesn't have to be necessarily aware of what's going on behind the scenes. Is that right?
That is absolutely the case. And leveraging that digital identity that we all have and applying the right level of analytics, that's kind of the path forward for at least the next 5 to 6 years.
All right, folks. Julie, thank you so much. Julie Conroy, Research Director at the ITE Group. This has been a fascinating conversation because this takes us outside of our comfort zone of things that we can easily control into sort of that squishy world where lots of maybes, lots of supporting infrastructure. I'm very curious to see where this is ultimately going to end up in the next couple of years. If you're telling me there's a 10-year ramp to get to some sort of major shift in identity federation, I don't know how I'm going to get there in 10 years with all these and still not, not be subject to the next 1,000 breaches.
Well, unfortunately, you will be subject to the next 1,000 breaches. that's going to happen just in the next, 9 months.
Yeah, that's fair. All right, Julie, thanks for being on the show. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, do you have a Twitter handle or a place people can contact you if they want more information or read more about what you're doing?
Absolutely. If they want to go to www.itegroup.com, AITEgroup.com, they can find our research.
Fantastic. Thanks a lot for being on the show, folks. Thanks for listening. Hope this has been entertaining. Episode 301 down. And, as we start to climb to 400, we're going to continue to diversify and provide you content that is both leadership focus and just a little bit outside of our realm of comfort to complete that picture for you. So thanks for listening. We'll see you on another time, another place, on another Down the Security Rabbit Hole podcast. For James and myself, we'll talk to you later. Ciao.
As we fade out on another Down the Security Rabbit Hole episode, we'd like to encourage you to chat with our hosts and guests using the Twitter hashtag #DTSR. Please check out the show notes, catch up on any episodes you may have missed, and subscribe so you don't miss a future episode. Our website is whiterabbit.net, whiterabbit.net. So on behalf of Rafal, James, for now it's goodbye. We'll see you soon on another Down the Security Rabbit Hole podcast.